Welcome back to Current State for Monday. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along. Aretha Franklin has made clear how she feels about the treatment she got at a Johnny Rockets restaurant in New York State. She ordered takeout. She ended up eating in the restaurant, and an unpleasant encounter with a restaurant employee unfolded. In a statement, Aretha described her server as, quote, very rude, unprofessional, and nasty. A Johnny Rockets representative told the AP the franchise owner is sorry for the actions of a, quote, new and very young employee. It's not often the word nasty makes the cut in a press release, but it did this time. We're talking about the Queen of Soul. That's Aretha. She can see. If she wants to say nasty, she can say nasty. It's actually kind of got my attention. Later this hour on our program, there's been an awful lot written in recent years over the future of pensions, specifically the declining future of pensions, defined benefit pensions, in lieu of an increasing number of defined contribution retirement vehicles. Melissa Benmark updates that score for us in just a little bit, and I'm sure you've heard of Fort Wayne, the city in Indiana, but before it was a city in Indiana, it was an actual fort in the city of Detroit. And WKAR Scott Pohl takes us to Detroit for a little history lesson on historic Fort Wayne in the city of Detroit. Our first guest today is a leading contender for the chance to represent Lansing and East Lansing in the U.S. Congress beginning next year. A recent Epic MRA poll shows former state Senate leader Mike Bishop enjoys a 12 percentage point lead over his closest competitor in the GOP-leaning 8th District. He has significantly outperformed that competitor, State Representative Tom McMillan, in fundraising, and he has received the endorsements of key organizations and Republicans, including the man he would like to replace, Congressman Mike Rogers. Why does Mike Bishop want to represent the 8th District? What would his priorities be as a U.S. congressman? To find out, we welcome Senator Mike Bishop to Current State. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Why do you want to be our congressman here in the 8th District?
Well, I'm eager to have the opportunity to represent the community that where I was born and raised. I've been a Michigander, and my family have enjoyed this great state of ours. I've got three kids. I'm married, and I believe I've got a vested interest in the future of this state. I've really enjoyed the opportunity to have represented my community in the past, and this is just a great opportunity to have that opportunity to do it in the United States Congress.
Well, talk to us about your very highest priorities if you were successful.
I think the highest priorities have got to be consistent with what I'm hearing on the campaign trail, which the concerns that I hear the most about are the economy and jobs, overregulation and government getting in the way of the private sector, especially small business, and the concerns about Obamacare and significant overreach by our government. And the third issue that I think I hear most about is debt and deficit. We just have too much debt in this country, and most people who live in our country have a low regard for our federal government because they don't believe they're acting in a way that's responsible. $18 trillion in debt is not responsible.
You can't talk about any kind of Republican electoral contest without involving Tea Party Republicans. From your perspective, how is the mainstream Republican, Tea Party Republican dynamic playing out in your race?
Well, I think the Tea Party is an interesting organization because historically the Tea Party stands for taxed enough already. And for the most part, they're principled patriots who believe that government has a purpose, and beyond that, they should not be involved. And that said, I believe that I've got a great support base from that organization. I have enjoyed that support base over the years, and I do believe they'll play a role. I think that that's the core group of citizens who have finally decided that they're 100% fed up with the current state of affairs in Washington today, and they want to see new leaders step up and get that government under control.
Congressional candidate, Republican Mike Bishop, is our guest here to start out Current State for Monday. Who do you think enjoys more Tea Party support, you or your competitor, Tom McMillan?
Oh, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I'm not sure how to answer that because the Tea Party organizations around the state don't have a central group that decides whether or not the entire Tea Party, for example, is going to endorse. But I can say I'm comfortable with the support that I have. I'm comfortable with the folks who believe in limited government and constitutional and the Constitution. Those folks have been supportive of me since I was Senate Majority Leader back in 2010.
What do you think separates you and Tom McMillan?
I think my experience is the most important part of my ability to serve in this capacity. I not only have been working in the private sector for the better part of my professional life, but I also had some experience in government, and that experience in government included a time as leader in the Senate where I actually had to lead a group across the finish line. We were able to control the size of government at a time when Democrats controlled our state legislature. We were able to pass budgets without tax increases, and over the 4 years that I was Senate Majority Leader, we actually had a reduction in the size of spending as opposed to previous years when spending went through the roof.
One of the hottest hot-button issues right now in Michigan and the nation is immigration and the plight of the thousands, tens of thousands, of young Central American asylum seekers who've shown up at our southern border in recent months. Here in Lansing, which you would represent, Mike Bishop, there is the beginning of an effort to allow some of these asylum seekers here in the capital city. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very sad. It's crushing to for me, especially as a parent, to see young children involved in this disaster, being used as pawns in this process, and victimized by a system that's completely broken. We are a nation of immigrants, and my family immigrated to this country. Yours did. We all did, and we have some real concerns about the way we handle immigration in this country. We should have public policy that addresses that issue, and unfortunately, these days, we simply don't have any public policy that's being enforced that does anything in a consistent way, and as a result, we have chaos on our borders.
But would you support the people who would welcome some of these young people to Lansing?
Oh, I support anybody who provides care and support for victims of this situation. But I don't believe in amnesty. I don't believe that we should just blow up the system that we have. I think it's about time that we secure our borders, that we provide the kind of resources necessary to ensure that our borders are secure, that we give our states on the border the opportunity to take measures they need to ensure that they're safe. I think we ought to be talking to other countries who provide these. There are countries in Central America and Mexico that have elected to circumvent our federal laws, international law, and allow this kind of activity to exist. They know exactly what they're doing, and they know that they're creating chaos in our country. And if they're doing this, we as a country ought to be scaling back our support for those countries. And if we have to cut foreign aid, we ought to be doing that.
But you would not resist an effort to welcome these foreign refugees to Lansing or elsewhere in the 8th District if it unfolded in that way.
I absolutely do not believe in amnesty. If that's what you're asking me, no, I don't believe that that's the solution. The solution is not just to open up the doors and accept people in that are not properly documented or who have not properly immigrated into our country. We still have a system in place. We are a nation of laws, and anybody who comes into our country has got to comply with those laws. And we can't just apply our laws in a willy-nilly fashion so as to allow folks to break the law at their convenience.
Mike Bishop is our guest. He is running for 8th District Republican nomination for the 8th Congressional District, which includes Lansing and East Lansing. I want to continue on this, though, because this gets really complicated. There would appear to be some significant amount of misunderstanding and confusion over this. And I'll refer back to a guest we had on the week before last, Congressman Dan Kildee, the Democrat who represents the 5th District, said he cautioned our listeners not to confuse the issue of the Central American asylum seekers with the broader topic of immigration reform. Is the issue of the refugees from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador different from the ongoing discussion, the broader discussion of immigration reform?
I don't see it as though it's different. To me, these are folks that either have immigrated legally or have not. And we have to learn how to draw the line. We are a nation of immigrants, but we are also a nation of laws. And I understand the plight of these, especially the children that have been involved, that have been used as a pawn in this process. But nevertheless, it does not change the fact that we have, in this country, have laws created to ensure that we have legal immigration. It doesn't matter if they're from Central America or from Mexico or where they're coming from. We have a responsibility to ensure that they immigrate legally. And if they do not immigrate legally, then we ought to turn them right back around again and send them back to the country from whence they came.
I think what an awful lot of people seem to be confused about is the Wilberforce Act, which was signed into law by President Bush back in 2008, which was meant to address human trafficking and actually calls for the legal status of these young people to be clarified when they show up. The Wilberforce Act would appear to obligate the United States to clarify their legal status before they are sent back home. It just seems to me there's a great deal of confusion over that particular act. Ironically, President Obama wants to alter the provisions of the Wilberforce Act. Let's move on to Obamacare. Share your thoughts with us on that. You touched on this previously. Specifically, would you join any future efforts to repeal it?
I would. I think it's important that the next Congress look very carefully at not just repealing the Affordable Care Act, but also replacing it with something that's more responsible. And the Congress set down a path when it came to Obamacare to, from what I understand, to control the cost. That was the real problem, the cost of health care. And in the end, all they figured out was how to pay for it. And the moment you decide that government will pay for it, it becomes a problem because that's an unsustainable cost over time. And if you don't have a solution for the spiraling cost of healthcare, you've not only not solved the problem, you've created a far bigger one. And that's what's happened here. We have a system in place that that allows our federal government to basically continue down the same path that we're on and print money to cover the cost. And it's going to bury small business. I'm in small business right now, and I can tell you that we want to offer new jobs, hire new folks here at the International Bank Card in Oakland County. We have good-paying jobs, but we won't do it because of the threat of Obamacare and what it can do to our company. And until that cloud clears on the horizon, there are going to be a lot of small businesses like ours that are frozen in place that will not hire, and it's destroying our economy right now. And I really do believe that if we do not address this and do it quickly, this economy is going to be in a really bad state of affairs. And it's our responsibility to make sure we step up and take care of it right away.
How is it destroying our economy?
Well, it's putting a mandate on especially our small businesses, to provide a cost that simply is unworkable, unmanageable, unsustainable. And the restriction, the regulation on small business is just one of many. But this one is crushing. And eventually it will take over every bit of our profit in this company and make it almost a penalty to be in business.
Is there another way to provide health care for the millions of Americans who go without it, short of Obamacare?
I don't know that. I think what we have to do is the most important thing we could be doing right now is working on this economy to get it back up and running again, so that more job providers out there are hiring, so that more folks get a paid position. Able-bodied folks are getting a paid position to work with benefits. That to me is the best solution for this problem. But really, the problem is not so much what we've been talking about. The problem is the spiraling costs of healthcare. We've done nothing to address that. They continue to spiral up and away. And until we create an environment that's patient-centered, that allows patients to go out and select their own forms of healthcare, to find their own prescription drug plans, to go across state lines to compete, to create that environment where insurers have to compete for a patient's business. We simply are not going to be able to control the costs. We in Michigan are allowed to, in certain circumstances, if you're a part of a certain genre of business, to pool your health care. It allows companies and school communities, for example, to pool their health care to be able to control their costs, which is a great way of going about it. We used to be able to use health savings accounts, which would allow employees to create their own accounts, to take more control of their own medical future. Yet those have gone by the wayside.
We're just about out of time here. There's an awful lot that has been written in recent years about the Norquist pledge that obliges people in Congress and the Senate to resist new tax increases that are not provided for by new revenue. Would you sign the Norquist pledge if you're elected?
I would, and the reason why I would is it's not so much a pledge to not raise taxes, which I'm not inclined to do, but the Norquist pledge is more about the size and scope of government. The Norquist pledge says that you agree not to agree to a tax increase without somewhere down the line finding a way to reduce the size of government, to cut in the, so that you're not continually growing the size at an unsustainable rate. To me, that's responsible government, and I think it's a no-brainer.
Mike Bishop is the leading Republican to get the primary nod for November's general election here to represent us in Lansing and East Lansing and all over the 8th District. Mike Bishop, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Current state on WKAR will point out that Mike Bishop's primary contender, leading primary contender, State Rep. Tom McMillan, joins us tomorrow here on Current State. Our Scott Pohl has been meeting historian Jack Dempsey at historic sites around Detroit here this summer, and he's back with another installment today. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. This time around, Jack and I stopped by Fort Wayne in Detroit. Going back to the Civil War, this was an important military installation for about 100 years. It's fallen on hard times, and as Jack Dempsey explains, the future of this place is connected to the proposal to build a new international bridge between Detroit and Windsor, Ontario.
It was constructed beginning in the 1830s as part of the Third Coastal Defense System, which was an attempt to protect our sea coasts and lake shores from foreign attack. Here on the Detroit River, it would be most likely from the Canadians, which today seems rather silly, but in the 1830s, we had just fought the War of 1812, which involved British troops in Canada, and we also had something called the Patriot War, where Americans were going over to Canada to try to make it part of the U.S. So this fort was constructed because it was seen as a necessary part of our national defense.
And it was part of the national defense in one fashion or another through the Vietnam era.
Absolutely right. It was a place for troops to muster, organize, and train during the Civil War. It was also a mustering point for our soldiers in World War I and for World War II, and then up to and including serving as an induction center for the Vietnam conflict.
Historic Fort Wayne was named for General Anthony Wayne, as was Wayne County. And people also referred to him as Mad Anthony. What can you tell me about General Anthony Wayne?
He was a one of those military leaders who took no prisoners, I guess you'd say. He was not shy and reticent, a vigorous leader, helped take this part of the Northwest Territory and make it part of the U.S. of A. So his leadership, military leadership, in the Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan part of the Northwest Territory was critical to making sure that this land, these acres, were part of the U.S.
In all its many years protecting Detroit from Canada and in the years since then, there was never a shot fired in anger here.
That's correct. It was not, as it turned out, the scene of any really significant military conflict. But when you look at the fact that it was a place for soldiers to rendezvous, get trained, and then sent off to war, obviously its military significance is still very striking. Also, it is part of the Detroit River history connection to the Underground Railroad, because right across the river from where we are, Canada, slaves escaping from bondage down in the south, as soon as they crossed the river, they were free, and the Canadian government did not, with rare exceptions, send them back. They did not extradite them. So the emergency manager recently, in a talk up on Mackinac Island, referred to the fact that this river is part of the Underground Railroad from Fort Wayne all the way up the river. So it is part of that conflict as well, both an immediate impact on humanity trying to secure freedom.
One of its other uses during World War II was housing prisoners from Italy.
We had actually several prison camps in Michigan that housed German, Italian prisoners, and it's an interesting function that you could take this military installation and house the enemy, so to speak. And now, obviously, after the war, we're much more allied with Germany than during the 20th century. And so it's another example of how history has all of these ebbs and flows and changes and really fascination.
We're talking with Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission about historic Fort Wayne in the city of Detroit. And I want to ask you about the current condition of historic Fort Wayne. It's open to the public on weekends. What will people see if they visit historic Fort Wayne, and what kind of condition is the fort in?
Thanks to some volunteers who have been laboring mightily for the last 10, 15 years, it is in a condition to be visited, but it's not nearly in the condition that it should be. The walls of the historic fort itself, the Star Fort, have been crumbling. A lot of the buildings that housed the officers and served other functions are in bad shape. Recently, one of the structures had to be torn down because it was just in such an unsafe condition. And when you compare this historic site to one in Canada, Fort Henry in Kingston, Ontario, same thing. No hostile shot ever fired there. Part of their defense system against us, but the Canadian government, the provincial government of Ontario, have taken that site, given it TLC, and it's a fantastic visitor attraction, part of their heritage. It would be great if down the road here, and hopefully not too long, that we could compare our historic Fort Wayne to their historic Fort Henry and have that both on the same kind of visitor experience. That would be great.
Geographically, historic Fort Wayne will one day, if the new international bridge crossing is built, it will sort of be surrounded almost by the entrance and exit ramps and the new plaza that they're talking about building for a new international bridge crossing. If it should come to that, what might that mean to the future of historic Fort Wayne?
Excellent question, Scott. I think it would be difficult for us as Michiganders to leave the site in the condition it is, because we'd have people coming from Canada, we'd have people coming from other states through this site, and if it's an eyesore, if it's an embarrassment to us, I don't think we could countenance that. So I hope with the investment that would come from this bridge crossing and the plaza, that somehow as a society we'd figure out a way to put resources into this site. It's not a question of whether we have resources. We clearly do. It's more a question of priorities.
One last thing. In spending a few minutes looking at the Historic Fort Wayne website, there's a schedule of events there that people can take in. And it's made up primarily, I noticed, with games of vintage baseball where men play with no glove. And it recreates what baseball was like as the 1800s became the 1900s. So if nothing else, there's something fun that baseball fans might enjoy if they consider a visit to Historic Fort Wayne.
Very true. There's also some other sporting events. I believe there are soccer events here that folks from the community participate in. And there is the occasional Civil War reenactment that goes on here. Sometimes there's an actual Civil War Days event that the volunteers put on. And people of goodwill just come here and try to talk about our history, our heritage, and attract others here. And some of those funds do support maintenance. So all of that is obviously trying to keep the site functioning and available for people to come see.
Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission, thanks for this lesson on Historic Fort Wayne in the city of Detroit.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. You can follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. I also want to briefly extend an invitation to join me and the four Democratic candidates for the 8th District Congressional seat tomorrow night, starting at 7:30 at Central United Methodist Church in downtown Lansing. The Lansing State Journal's Elaine Culhannock and I will be spending 90 minutes or so with the candidates, and you are welcome to attend. 7:30 tomorrow night, Central United Methodist Church, downtown Lansing. Last Friday, General Motors announced plans for a $37 million expansion of its Delta Township auto production plant just west of Lansing. GM will ask the city of Lansing for a tax incentive package to help finance the project. The company will make its initial request to the Lansing City Council this evening. However, one former GM community has some things to say about the potential pitfalls of granting such a deal. And Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to explain more. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Mark. GM is asking for an incentive package that would cut its property taxes in half over 12 years. The automaker says it will still provide $4 million in new taxes back to the city over that period of time. This type of package is permitted under a state law that's called Public Act 198. Now, years ago, GM operated two plants in Ypsilanti Township. The township gave the company something like $200 million in tax abatements. But GM eventually closed both of those plants, the first one in 1992, the second in 2010. That left Ypsilanti taxpayers holding the bag, having devoted a lot of money that they say could have gone to other things like education. The township sued GM, and eventually a new state law was created that helps protect communities from this type of scenario. I spoke with Doug Winters about this. He is the township attorney at Ypsilanti Township. He says his community's experience is a cautionary tale for Lansing and for any other municipality in Michigan that might one day consider cutting deals with General Motors.
If Delta Township is considering this tax abatement, I would definitely encourage them to take advantage of that change in state law that came about because of our court case that now requires them to enter into contracts with local communities. But as we've seen in their bankruptcy, even those contracts may not always be strong enough.
Okay, but there are stronger protections, as you are alluding. Can you describe what those protections call for in the law? Is it a matter of GM makes a commitment to a community for X number of years before they can even consider a closure or a pullout of some sort?
Well, what we have done in, under the law now is there's a provision called a clawback, which means if you close the plant or relocate outside the township, that you have to pay the taxes that you would have paid but for the tax abatement. Most corporations will agree to do that kind of a clawback. I don't think GM will. At the same time, you can also negotiate employment in regards to certain levels being maintained, and you can put that in the contract that requires them to give an annual report as to whether or not they met their employment goals. That's supposedly one of the main reasons behind why the statute exists to begin with, is not just to give out money like corporate welfare would be, it's simply to get something back in return. And that quid pro quo was supposed to be creation and retention of jobs, not just giving General Motors a blank check because they're General Motors.
When the lower court ruled in Ypsilanti's favor before the appeal process began, did the township receive any money back? Did it recoup any losses at all that GM owed them?
No, what we were fighting for at the time was for the retention of jobs, because that was what our focus was on, because but for the retention and creation of jobs, these incentives become almost like a corporate welfare state, because they don't really help. The opinion is pretty sharply divided that they don't really work. And at the same time, it's really questionable whether or not their decision-making is based upon incentives, because right now, every state does it. So what they look at more importantly is the skilled workforce, the availability of their product to transportation systems. There's probably about 10 other factors that have much more of a bearing on whether to invest in a plant than whether or not they get a tax abatement.
Has your community rebounded to any degree? Is it as vital economically as it once was, or is a lot of that now gone?
Well, we struggled for this reason. A lot of our housing and subdivisions were built to support those auto facilities back in the 60s and 70s. And so when the plants closed in the 90s, and then a few years ago the last plant closed, and then you couple that with the housing implosion and crisis, we had one of those perfect storm situations to where we were leading the county in the number of foreclosures. We had a third of the foreclosures, about 15% of the county's population. So we've had to get smart in terms of how we use our resources. We're doing more with less. We're investing heavily into the IT. We're slowly but steadily making progress toward recouping our tax base. And we've done everything we can to stabilize our neighborhoods. But when GM closes their plant, like they've done in many parts of Michigan, they leave behind in their wake a lot of problems for the communities to deal with. And so you have to look long and hard at just how serious their commitment is when you give a tax abatement to General Motors. And again, I don't think General Motors really would need a 12-year tax abatement myself. If they do, fine, you get 12 years, but you sign a contract that has a clawback provision that says if you leave or close the plant in year six, you pay back to every taxing unit the dollars you would have paid but for that abatement. And if they can't say that, then it gives you a pretty good indication as to the trust level you can have. And because if they're committed, they should be all in.
The takeaway then, Mr. Winters, is that your community's legal action against General Motors paved the way for a new state law that provides more protections, but nonetheless, Lansing, Delta Township, anybody who comes after needs to keep both eyes open regardless.
Yes, absolutely. And I think right now that at least one thing that we're very proud of is that we do get a lot of phone calls over the years from other communities, even outside of Michigan, and as to how they can strengthen their contracts with corporations. It may not always be GM. It could be Boeing. It could be any number of corporations out there. And because they don't want to be left holding the bag where they have a promise that sounds great that we're going to invest in your community. And again, the schools, the community colleges give up a significant dollars, and then in a few years they'll close the plant. And we understand the economic realities, but at the same time, it has to be a two-way street here. You can't just give money to an organization because you like them. There has to be something in return that benefits that community. And for us, the benefit was supposed to be job retention, job creation. And there's got to be accountability. And don't just sign that check and walk away, because you got to keep a close eye on what they're doing. And they should be forthright about how many jobs they've actually created or retained, and not just, you know, give you a PR report. It's got to be some hard data. And they have it. They track it. They have the ability to produce it.
Doug Winters is the township attorney for Ypsilanti Township. Mr. Winters, thank you for sharing the story of your community and how it may relate to what's happening here in the Lansing area. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and good luck to all the communities in the state that can take advantage of this new law. So, thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And by the way, we're going to look more broadly at whether these incentive packages really produce the economic development they promise later this week here on Current State. From the Detroit bankruptcy to a high-profile lawsuit against phone giant Verizon, pensions are in the news lately. WKAR's Melissa Benmark has been thinking about the changing state of pensions, and she joins me now. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. All the talk about pensions being frozen, reduced, bought out, sold to insurance companies, I just wanted to get kind of a pensions 101 perspective. So I talked to Leslie Papke. She's a professor of economics here at MSU. And I know a lot of these questions may seem really obvious to some folks, but to me, they really weren't, and it just seemed kind of a murky sea. So I wanted to kind of get down to some basics. I started out by having her define the different types of pensions.
Defined contribution plans are popularized by 401k plans. Those are pension plans where individuals may contribute, and their employers often contribute or match as part of their contribution. And the benefit that you receive at retirement is a function of how much money is in that account. Often, the participant gets to direct the investments. So it's very much an individual-centered account that the individual is responsible for. The employer makes contributions, often makes contributions, but that's the extent of the employer's involvement. The employer will often give you choices, limit your investment choices. The other type of pension plan is what's referred to as the traditional or defined benefit pension plan, where your benefit is defined by a formula at retirement, and the formula is something like your average salary for your highest paid 3 or 5 years times the number of years you worked for the firm times some kind of accrual percentage, like 1% of your salary per year of service. And the firm is responsible for investing contributions enough to make those payments to you at your retirement, and you are not responsible at all for any investment choices. It's entirely the liability of the firm.
Is it fair to say that for the most part, the defined benefit pension, as many of our parents knew it, is pretty much a thing of the past?
Defined benefit pensions in the private sector have certainly gone by the wayside. There are many that remain. I'm trying to remember the exact number, maybe 20,000, but this is down from a high of more like 80,000 to 100,000 plans. And firms have generally stopped providing pension benefits or moved to the defined contribution form because it reduces the firm's risk, the firm's investment risk, and their longevity risk. But also, some people would argue that workers have asked for defined contribution plans because they are mobile, and defined benefit pension plans really are not. And if the typical worker only stays with an employer for maybe 8 years, it helps to have a mobile pension.
Talk about pension buyouts where a company offers a lump sum in place of the pension. Why do corporations do that, and what is the effect on the employee who takes a buyout instead of the pension?
It's important to understand that the pension is paid in the form of an annuity. So you receive a level payment until your death, and generally 50% of your payment will continue to until your spouse dies. So the choice is between an annuity, so a level payment till your death, possibly with some COLA, cost of living adjustment, or you can take, you know, the cash today, a lump sum. If you take the cash today, then you're in charge of investing it and seeing that it lasts over your lifetime. So what the firm has done is move the longevity risk, the risk of outliving your resources, to you if you take the lump sum. You, though, have more information about your lifespan than the firm does. So you may think that you, based on your parents' and grandparents' lifespan, you may think you can manage the money long enough. Maybe you want to start a business and a lump sum would come in handy right now. You do have to assume the investment risk, and most people are really not, many people, I'll say, are not really prepared to do that. You could take your lump sum and buy an annuity yourself. That might be silly, though, because the annuity market is very expensive, and the firm itself is already offering you an annuity. So you have to weigh your concern about what you know about finances and how long you think you're going to live in making that choice. You should also keep in mind that it's likely that you're covered by Social Security, which is already offering you an annuity. So part of your retirement income is already annuitized, but you want to plan on having at least a third or more of your retirement income come from some sort of pension plan. So you want to see if that's going to be adequate replacement in retirement.
So one thing that also happens then, sometimes after a lump sum has been offered, is that the company does something called de-risking that has to do with working with an insurance company to make an employee annuity. Is that correct? Could you tell us about that?
The firm decides to buy an annuity for the employee from an insurance company. That would appear as a one-time payment for the firm and removes the pension obligation from the firm's books. So that takes all the longevity risk away. The firm has purchased this annuity payment for you or the worker and is no longer worried about having to meet that long-term obligation. They've paid the insurance. So it de-risks the firm of investment risk, having to meet the obligation, longevity risk, how long the worker is going to live. It, of course, removes control from the firm. And the firm could benefit from the assets in the pension if the assets do well. So what the firm is thinking is they no longer want to possibly benefit from high investment returns in their pension.
In this era of cutbacks so many places and companies going under and that kind of thing, what do you do if the company that holds your pension goes out of business?
You mean you're asking if you're receiving an annuity from your current firm?
Or one that has been sold to another company, like, for instance, if your pension was turned over to Prudential and turned into an annuity.
Well, those are really two different situations. When the firm has bought the insurance policy that is going to pay your annuity, then that's the liability of Prudential, and the company has nothing to do with it, and it's all about how solvent Prudential is and whether those payments are backed by our financial oversight. If your company goes out of business or merges with someone else, then they can, of course, change your pension at any time. They can change the terms of the pension formula going forward. They could freeze your pension and offer no pension or offer something less generous. What they must do, though, is pay you the pension you have earned up to the point of that change. So up to the point of the amendment or the merger, you have a federally guaranteed right to that pension benefit at that point.
With companies getting sold to one another and turnover and change and that kind of thing, I can kind of imagine scenarios where people who had a pension with one company that then got bought up by another company or something could actually get to where they couldn't locate their pension. Are there resources available for people to kind of track who holds their pension and how to get to a human being to talk to them about it?
I actually want to mention that for many firms that have the lifestyle you're describing, chances are they're offering a defined contribution plan, and you would receive your pension account as you could transfer it to your new employer, or you could roll it over to an IRA and manage it yourself. And then, of course, you would know where it was because these accounts are in your name. This idea of losing contact with your defined benefit pension would be addressed by several federal agencies who have an interest in in oversight. One of them is the Department of Labor, who has the Employee Benefits Security Administration, has a website where you can look up your pension and look up the recent financial reports, find out who the plan administrator is. It has phone numbers, people you can contact. Also, if there was any question of solvency, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a federal agent that guarantees defined benefit pensions, monitors all these firms that they insure, and they keep track of who the contacts are, and they can respond to your questions about what's happening with your pension plan.
So at the end of the day, are there really any guarantees that you will get the pension you worked for when you are retired and need it?
There is a federal guarantee for defined benefit pensions. And for most people, even if their firm went bankrupt and was unable to make pension payments, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation would assume those payments, and it would be a full payment for about 85% of the workers. For highly paid workers, it probably wouldn't be their full pension, because those benefits are capped at about $55,000 a year that the PBGC can pay. But the majority of pensions are federally insured, and people will receive them.
Dr. Papke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And if you want to know more about those website resources we just mentioned, the labor site is DOL, for Department of Labor, .gov/EBSA. The pension guarantee site is PBGC.gov. As long as we're on the economy and finance and money, there's encouraging signs regarding wages in America. Some say they are going up. Paul Davidson in today's USA Today, quote, wage growth is accelerating in several key industries, leisure and hospitality, business services, construction and retail, this according to the U.S. Labor Department. Monthly job growth has taken off nicely in recent months, according to Mr. Davidson, but wages have tended to remain stuck at around 2%, barely enough to keep track with inflation. There are mounting signs, however, that pay hikes are poised to gain momentum in the second half of 2014. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. MSU grad Bill Schneider operates Wild Type Native Plant Nursery in Mason. WKAR's Peter Worf's been taking us there this summer to hear about Schneider's work and his expertise in the field. In this recent visit, Peter and Bill talk about the increasing public awareness of the importance of native plants.
Well, I think there are two things, maybe many more things that are occurring in our culture. One is that there is greater awareness among the public of the benefits of using native plants. People are tired of traditional landscapes, the chemicals and energy and time that is required to maintain those kinds of landscapes. But there's also a lot of mandated requirements that involve the use of native plants. I mentioned earlier about stormwater issues. A lot of required stormwater projects require by city, county, or state mandate that native plants be used. So there are, I think, are a couple of things that are occurring simultaneously, and they're not necessarily independent of one another. They're kind of interrelated.
So we've gone outside now. Where are you going to take us now, Bill?
Well, I was going to take you into the greenhouse that we call the Big House. No reference to the University of Michigan Big House. This is just our largest house. And I think it gives a nice visual effect. The plants we've just looked at in the germ house are transplanted and put into this house. So it's just a bigger version of what you saw a minute ago. The plants are bigger, the textures are more pronounced. You get to see the end product. These larger plug flats is actually what we sell to the public and to our contractors.
These are the things that people will be carrying out of here.
Right. Yeah. And from this space, they, when things are going well, head out the door. Here are the beginning of our oak production here. These are oaks grown from acorns this season, and these will be transplanted next week into larger containers.
What types of oaks are these?
So we're growing something like 8 or 9 species of native oaks. What you're looking at here are things like chicopin oak, red oak, black oak, swamp white oak, bur oak.
And these will go out this small?
These will be transplanted into a larger container size and then put outside for the year, and they'll be ready to sell next summer.
They'll be a little bigger.
Yeah.
So we're back outside.
So what we're looking at here is the latter stages of the shrub and tree production. We have trees in pots that are placed in the ground on drip irrigation, and then we have smaller containers in hoop houses that we have constructed to keep them protected during the winter, but otherwise they're just growing outside. We do grow and sell a lot of wetland shrubs. Wetland shrubs are in many ways underappreciated and sometimes underutilized. I think people are catching on that these plants have great utility. They are many larval hosts for butterflies. They absorb water, clean water, slow water, have many, many attributes that have been underappreciated by certainly our retail customers. And among the engineers and landscape architects out there, they have been well aware of the utility of these plants. And we are a supplier of a lot of wetland shrubs.
What would some of those be?
We have shrub dogwoods, shrubs called ninebark, nannyberry, arrowwood viburnum, swamp rose, bog birch. Could go on and on and on.
What are some of the more rare things that we might find here? Some of the things that you'd kind of have to dig deep for as you're looking for seed or trying to find these plants?
Well, we do grow a number of these kinds of plants, but I'll list some of them off as I can draw them in my memory. But what we really are growing here are some of the most common, what used to be historically common species that are now rather uncommon.
I see.
But uncommon to the public.
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned bog birch. This is a shrub. It's a birch. Very common, but virtually unknown by the public and even among our more sophisticated professionals that specify plants.
Huh.
So I would call that one of the quirky shrubs that we grow. Oak that we grow, shingle oak, very uncommon in Michigan, found only in a handful of sites. More common south of Michigan.
Yeah.
That's an oak we grow and are very proud to be growing it from seed. And I could go on and on with the unusual, some of the unusual, more unusual things that we grow, things like snowberry and buckbean is a wetland plant that we grow. Some of these names are great.
I love the names.
Yeah.
Bill Schneider is owner of Wild Type in Mason, Michigan. Bill, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
It's like Henry Ford, and maybe he did this, you know, it's like, I'm going to go up to the UP and mine some.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow here on WKAR's Current State, Mike Bishop's Republican opponent in next week's primary, State Representative Tom McMillan joins us. We'll also have our Great Lakes Month in Review, and we'll speak with a charter school authorizer about authorizers' responsibilities in Michigan charter schools. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.